Oliver.
The 70th anniversary of the outbreak of World War II this week will pass almost unnoticed in the Czech Republic. The reason is simple. For Czechs and Slovaks, the tragedy did not begin with the invasion of Poland in 1939, but a full year earlier. With the Munich Agreement of September 1938, Britain, France and Italy gave Hitler the green light to annex huge tracts of Czechoslovakia, and less than 6 months later, Nazi troops marched into what was left of the Czech lands unopposed. So how did Hitler get away with bringing a determined and well-defended democratic country under the sway of the swastika, while Czechoslovakia's allies stood by? The British historian and politician, David Faber, has tried to answer this question in his book, Munich, the 1938 Appeasement Crisis, which focuses above all on the role of the British political establishment, in particular Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. This is the most detailed account of the events leading up to Munich to be published for several decades, and an American edition is due out this month. I caught up with David Faber in London, and we discussed some of the many aspects of a book that deserves to become a classic.
I started off looking at the secondary sources, and we're very fortunate because we have many sets of memoirs of many of the key protagonists of the time from all the various different countries. So we're very lucky that we have an absolute wealth of material. Many of the key protagonists kept diaries, wrote their own memoirs subsequently, and it was really a bit like a jigsaw, piecing together all the individual quotes and the individual moments and times when things were happening. And very often I found that having looked at an event that had happened in London and an event that had happened, say, in Prague or in Berlin or even in Rome, that these two things had happened at roughly the same time. And so I was able to put people's speech side by side with each other as to what they'd been thinking in the different capitals of Europe at the time.
And the view of the Munich crisis from the perspective of the Czech Republic is very much that Britain let down Czechoslovakia, almost as if it were a foregone conclusion. From your book, I think you get a rather more nuanced picture of what was going on politically, that it maybe even needn't have happened that way.
The ultimate result is that, yes, Czechoslovakia was let down. And I think that in the end, both immediately in the aftermath of Munich and, of course, in March the following year in 1939, there is no doubt that Czechoslovakia had been let down by Britain and also by France, of course, and in many ways a closer ally of hers at the time. But I don't think that, and I agree with you, that I think none of the politicians really set out to do that. This wasn't a deliberate policy. I think Chamberlain's weaknesses were that he was a very arrogant and a very vain man, and I think that once he had set himself on a particular course, he decided that he was right and he really wouldn't brook any confrontation with anyone close to him. And his vanity led him to believe, especially after his meetings with Hitler, that he was in some way getting the better of Hitler, whereas, of course, in fact, the exact opposite was the case.
And it seems amazing that when you read contemporary sources, many people in Europe, including in Germany itself, really did think that Chamberlain had got the better of Hitler, didn't they?
They did. And, of course, in the immediate aftermath of the Munich crisis, albeit only for a few days or weeks, Chamberlain was perceived as a great hero, both in London, as indeed Daladier, the French Prime Minister, was in Paris. They were perceived as having pulled off a great coup, albeit at the expense of the hapless Czechs. And that didn't last very long. I think that there was a twofold sense that things had not gone right. The first was that I think the British people woke up to the fact that this was, from a purely selfish point of view, unlikely to postpone war forever. Of course, one of the most important things to recognise is that Chamberlain and the people immediately around him, however much he may have been lauded in the future for postponing war and enabling the Allies to be better prepared for the Second World War, that was not his intention. His intention, as he proudly boasted when he came back from Munich, was to achieve peace for all time, and he firmly believed that he had achieved peace. The second thing was that the British people in particular, and I think the French also, did recognise and felt a strong sense of guilt on behalf of the Czechs. And there was a great outpouring of support for Czechoslovakia in the months after the Munich crisis. There was a very famous story that the Lord Mayor of London set up a fund to help to send money to Czechoslovakia and to help many of the refugees who'd had to flee the Sudeten areas, and that Chamberlain was alleged to have told him that he didn't want this fund to happen and that it would offend the Germans in some way. A really extraordinary thing now to look back on with hindsight. So there was a great outpouring of relief that war had been averted, but I think guilt and shame that the Czechs were being forced to go through what they did.
I'm very interested in the fact that you have written this book as a person who has his own political background. You were a member of parliament, of the British Parliament, for the Conservative Party. In your own family, there is also a link with this episode in 20th century history, in that your grandfather was the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. In what ways have, well, your family experiences and also your experiences as an active politician influenced the way that you perceived the episode? They must have given you some insights into the way that politics works, for example.
It did very much. I mean, taking the family connection first of all, yes, I was obviously very proud of my grandfather and was very relieved, although I knew it when I started writing the book, to discover that he'd been on the right side of the argument, as I perceived it, that he had been a great anti-appeaser in the late 1930s. And obviously, having read his autobiographies and many of his papers, I knew what his views had been at the time. As far as my own political experience goes, I found that absolutely invaluable in writing the book. Anyone who knows about a specific world and knows how it operates, whatever it happens to be, obviously has a slight insight. And so I was particularly fascinated by the ins and outs, the political comings and goings. I could picture the geography of where the meetings took place, of where the debates were being held, of where some of the cabinet meetings even were being held. And so I was able to, if not picture the people, picture the scene around them and know what they were going through. I think there was something that also very important and a very strong connection to my own much briefer political career. When I first got into the British House of Commons in 1992, it was at the height of the debate within the Conservative Party over the degree to which the British Conservative Party, the British government, should be at the heart of Europe. This was a iconic issue within the Conservative Party, and the pressure to conform at the time and the pressure to toe the party line and to do as one was told by the senior politicians in your own party was enormous. And I could absolutely sense, when I was researching the Munich crisis, this same feeling of pressure and almost of a bullying pressure being applied from the senior government, by the Prime Minister down, onto the junior politicians, the backbenchers, as they're called in the British Parliament.
I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I'm interested in the fact that you mentioned European integration, because I would have thought that one of the messages of Munich would be that the more democratic countries integrate with one another, not just economically but also politically, the stronger the pressure is on those forces which are undemocratic not to undermine the group of democratic nations, of nations which are in some way politically and economically bonded.
Well, of course, you're quite right to say that, and I agree absolutely with that. And you mentioned my grandfather, and I come from a very strong pro-European tradition. I studied modern languages at university. I've been fortunate enough to travel widely in Europe, and I come from a political tradition within the Conservative Party, which there still is, thankfully, of a much closer union and strong ties with the rest of Europe. But as we know, throughout generations and throughout different periods of history, nothing is ever as simple as it seems. And certainly in the early 1990s, when I took my own first steps in politics, and there still is indeed today, I hasten to add, there was a very strong body of opinion within the Conservative Party and within some of the other parties as well, which opposed greater European integration. I mean, as we speak today, the current leader of the Conservative Party has moved away from the mainstream within the European Parliament to sit with other people. And it is, in many ways, you could say there are items of history that repeat themselves almost relentlessly through the years. But you could say that people never learn the lessons of the past in that respect.
One of the very interesting issues in connection with the Munich debate is that there is no consensus internationally, and there's certainly no consensus in Britain, about Neville Chamberlain's decision to appease Hitler. To this day, there is quite a strong body of thought, and there have been books written about it, arguing that Chamberlain was doing the right thing, that he was gaining time, that it made Britain stronger in the run-up to the Second World War, the fact that he did appease Hitler in 1938. In a sense, in writing about Neville Chamberlain's role in a very negative way, you could be accused by people in your own party of fouling your own nest. He was a conservative politician. There are still many conservatives who would sympathise with his decision then.
Funnily enough, I'm not sure that the issue of support for Chamberlain necessarily divides along party lines. I think that the Conservatives as a party are not particularly enamoured of Neville Chamberlain when they look back. He gets a very bad press, by and large, from conservative, with a small c, writers and observers. But you're quite right that his reputation has suffered ups and downs over the past 60, 70 years. In the immediate aftermath of the war, of the Second World War, he was really vilified in this country. Then in the 1970s, a lot of the government papers relating to this period were released, and many historians at the time, or a number of historians, took the opportunity, as you rightly say, to write pro-Chamberlain works, along the lines, very much as you say, that he was actually quite perspicacious in looking ahead and in appeasing Hitler, and that he did buy us time, that, for instance, the first Spitfires that fought in the Battle of Britain only rolled out of the factories just in time for the Battle of Britain in 1940, and that had we had to go to war in 1938 over Czechoslovakia, we would have been ill-prepared. I think nowadays there are fewer historians who are prepared to take that line. Yes, I have taken a line in my book that Chamberlain was at fault, but I base that not so much on his political decisions. What I found very difficult to sympathise with, reading his letters in particular, his own contemporary narrative of the period, was that he did believe really much too firmly in his own ability and in his own political credibility. He used to use this expression called the Chamberlain effect. He really believed that he had some kind of momentous effect on everyone he met, including Hitler, and he was badly mistaken in that. He ran an extraordinarily undemocratic government, and indeed the decisions at the time of the Munich crisis were taken by a very small group of people, all of whom were signed up to and utterly committed to his own political line.
David Faber, your book, Munich, the 1938 Appeasement Crisis, was published last year in 2008, and it's just come out, I believe, in paperback as well, hasn't it?
It has. It's just come out in paperback, and I'm happy to say it seems to be doing very well. And it's coming out in America in September 2009, which is very exciting, and I think it's a period of history that the Americans seem to be fascinated by. There was American involvement at the time of Munich. Roosevelt was closely in touch with what was going on, although was not really in a position to alter events in the end. But there's no doubt that in America, the word Munich is a dirty word. It is undoubtedly a word which implies appeasing dictators, and successive American presidents since the Second World War have often used that to justify their foreign policy.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.